Gaiska, take care of the pretender's horse, Canis said without looking. Oh, and fetch me a jug of wine from the back right saddlebag. The Empress gave me half a dozen as a parting gift.
The woman glared over her shoulder at Kyaire, but he didn't seem to notice. She moved from her horse to his and fished through the saddlebags on the rear of his mount. The jugs of wine were easy to spot. They were large clay pots with fist-sized corks on the top. They poked out of the leather bags like peeping children, and each probably held 3 gallons of liquid and weighed more than I could lift. The woman pulled one out and eyed it carefully. I watched her glance over at Kenneth, but the large man was still occupied with his horse. She looked to Kyaire, but his attention was on the fire. Her scowl grew more sinister before she wound out her arm slowly and hurled a massive clay jug at the back of Kyaire's head. I tried to scream a warning, but by the time the sound had left my mouth, Kyaire had somehow uncorked the jug and had it pressed to his lips. I had not even seen him move, avoid the bottle, catch it, or uncork it, and the scream choked off in my throat like a meek cry. That got Canis' attention.
What happened?
He turned away from his mount. He looked at me, and his light blue eyes shot ice that froze my tongue.
I almost dropped the wine. These chains make me clumsy.
Kyaire took a swallow of the liquid while he glanced over his shoulder to smile at Canis. Our eyes met for a second, and the handsome man winked at me again. Kenneth had probably guessed what had happened, and shot Gaiska a gaze that would have cleaned rust off of iron. The woman furiously went to work on Kyaire's horse, removing the rest of the saddlebags and saddle before walking it over next to Kenneth's mount for a rubdown.
Thank you, my errand,
Kyaire said when the woodsman handed him a steamy bowl of stew. The tall man nodded and then handed another bowl to Kenneth when he sat down. The big man carried a frightening axe that he casually set behind him. It was black and seemed as if it had been carved out of a jagged piece of granite. Finally, I tore my gaze away from the weapon and looked toward my lover. Kyaire seemed completely occupied by his food, and for a while the only sounds in the camp were the crackling of the fire and the clink of the chains around his wrists. The sight of his manacles made me angry. He shouldn't be treated like a criminal. Kyaire was the most wonderful man I had ever met. He had risked his life to save me and had shown me amazing passion. I imagined him being dragged before a group of men that looked like Kenneth, with endless muscles and hateful expressions. They would judge him unfairly and then remove his head with an axe. The thought of my lover being killed so horribly, or even tortured beforehand, made me feel sick to my stomach.
The moon here is quite dark. You should smile, Kenneth.
Kyaire nodded to the bigger man and then passed his bowl to Ayaren, who promptly filled it again from the iron pot and returned it.
Once my mission is completed, I'll be happy.
Kenneth didn't look up when he spoke and took a careful bite of his stew to drive home the point that he wasn't in the mood to talk.
That is a pragmatic way to look at it. How much farther will we have to travel to reach the Radical? It will take us a few weeks.
Damn,
that far away.
Kyaire asked around a mouthful of stew.
It will take us that long because of the humans,
Anik said. He nodded toward Beltor and me.
You aren't going to let them go?
Kyaire's mouth twisted.
No, we will release them once you have come with us through the Radical.
Kenneth's voice wasn't as dark as Anik's, but the men could have been brothers for how similar in size they were.
That is probably smart. Otherwise, I'd just overpower the 6 of you and escape.
I doubt that,
Jason spit out hastily.
Reality is envisioned by many, but only created by a few. What does that mean?
Jason asked, but Kyaire merely shrugged and focused back on his bowl of stew.
How did you get those scars on your body? Gaiska asked.
My love had hundreds of cuts, puncture, and burn scars over most of his body. The only place that seemed to have never been damaged was his face.
How did you get those tattoos?
Kyaire asked without looking from his bowl of stew.
Before we were gifted, of course.
Jason's voice was full of mockery.
There you go.
Kyaire grunted. The others seemed slightly confused by his response. It looked like Gaiska and Jason wanted to ask more questions, but Kenneth glared at them and they held their tongues. though I sat near Kyair and the fire, and I felt cold. I was perceptive enough to sense that something was being left unspoken between the powerful men, but I was not clever enough to figure out what it was. I had not known Jason for more than a few days, but the man was quick to anger, and right now seemed ready to explode.
Kenneth.
My uncle's voice eased the tension that everyone seemed to be ignoring. The big man looked up from his stew and glanced indifferently at Beltor.
Your men here have told us some of what is at stake with Kyair, or, as you call him, the Pretender.
Kenneth nodded slowly and sat up on the log.
But he has been assisting us against the elven invasion of our country.
He did not do a good job, did he? Gazka said with a malicious smile.
My niece was abducted and this man saved her. Who knows what these elvens would have done with her had they succeeded. While he wasn't here, they attacked Naya. I can't expect someone to be in two places at once. Your story will not change my mission, human. I must take him back for judgment,
Kenneth said.
I understand that. I would like to ask for help. You are taking an invaluable asset from our world. Your men have spoken about your clan's values. It would seem that assisting our cause with some of your powerful troops, replacing what you are taking, would be in line with the opinion your men have of you. I will consider your request when I return with the Pretender,
Kenneth said. By then it will be too late. The words left my mouth quickly, and my voice surprised me. The large man turned his attention to me, and his bright blue eyes made me feel nervous. They are already in our kingdom, enslaving our people. From our understanding, it could take more than a year for your clan to speak to the council and ask for help. I continued despite my fear of the muscular man.
That is our way.
Though his words had a finality to them, I sensed that he could be persuaded. What more can we do to ask for help? This seems like a request that someone as powerful as you could grant with ease, I pressed.
His sister makes the decisions,
Kyair said with a laugh. Kenneth's face briefly flashed to rage. He looked across the fire toward my lover and seemed ready to stand.
Besides, you'd probably need 1,000 troops to scrape the elvens from this world. That would be over 1/4 of your warriors, wouldn't it?
Kyair's smile was infectious, but he didn't seem to realize that he was hindering our request. We needed Kenneth to be friendly to Naya. Kyair had a way of eliciting extreme emotions in those around him.
My sister and I serve our clan together, Pretender, hence the name Two Bears. You may not understand the concept of servitude, but it requires us to make decisions for the good of our people. Sending warriors to this world must be carefully planned, and the risks weighed against benefits for us all.
Kenneth struggled to get his emotions under control.
You may be the Two Bears, but I've only heard it called Ternia's clan. I'm sure another clan would be up for the job if you can't do it. I'll convince one when I am speaking to this council.
You are a fool,
Kenneth shouted. It sounded like a bear scream. Terror seized me, and I feared the men were about to come to blows.
The conversation between you and the council will be brief, and then you will be killed for violating our laws.
Kenneth's warrior seemed surprised by the big man's outburst. It was so loud that I felt the air vibrate.
So that's how the process works? You drag me in front of them, and they point fingers at me, tell me I am guilty, and then...
Kayo drew a finger across his neck.
Death? That is what I have been told. You haven't actually seen a pretender judged by these clan leaders.
Kyair took a sip of wine from the clay jug. He seemed completely relaxed despite Kenneth yelling at him.
No, only the leaders are present. So, there is a possibility of them listening to me.
He smiled at Kenneth.
No. Will you be there to judge me?
Kyair asked. I looked over to him and saw a smile slowly spread across his face. He obviously didn't grasp the seriousness of his situation.
Perhaps,
Kenneth grunted.
But your sister will?
Kyair's teeth shone white in the firelight. The two men stared at each other across the fire, and I expected the larger man to jump the flames and throttle Kyair.
You seem to take delight in harassing me, Pretender. I will have the last laugh when they remove your life from the thin shell of your body.
Kenneth's voice was the rumble of an avalanche, and I felt my ribs quiver.
I'm destined for execution, so perhaps you can allow me a little pleasure.
Kyair leaned back and laughed. Surprisingly, Kenneth's face changed, and he let out a low chuckle.
Fair enough, Pretender.
I wasn't the only one who seemed surprised by Kenneth's sudden change of emotion. His warriors glanced anxiously between their leader and Kyair. Aharon trembled as he stirred the pot of thickening pig stew. His mannerisms made me think of the times we had spent traveling. I had always thought that the woodsman seemed jittery. I now realized that it was Kyair who made him nervous. We still need help. What can I do to get aid from your clan? My voice came out with as much strength as I could muster. I had to be strong for my people. Kenneth looked back at me and shook his head, but I spoke again. I can join your clan. Jason and Annex said it was a possibility that I could be gifted.
I will consider your request while we travel.
Kenneth's eyes appraised me. I was used to having men look at me with desire, but his cold gaze was intimidating, and I tried to fight back my discomfort. He had lust in his eyes, but something deeper that disturbed me. I realized he was judging my worthiness to become one of them, to lead my people. It angered me that he felt he could determine my worth in a look, or even a few short weeks of travel.
Are we heading south?
Kyair asked. He had seemed completely uninterested in my exchange with Kenneth. I wondered if this was because he didn't understand what was happening, or because he was so confident in his plan to convince another clan to come help us that he was not worried about me needing Kenneth's help. I was a little disappointed that he did not seem jealous, and hoped it was not because he no longer cared for me.
Yes, Aharon said.
Kenneth looked over at Aharon, and the lanky man grimaced.
Don't be so hard on him. I would have found out eventually.
My lover brought the wine up to his lips. I marveled at how graceful his movements were. Even the simple act of drinking was done with the efficiency of a dancer.
I asked you about your conversation with the Empress, and you refused to answer. Aha! So that is why you are grumpy.
Kyair took another swig of the jug. He seemed to realize that he was the only one drinking, and he passed the wine to his left. Beltor grasped it and lifted it to his lips, taking a small sip before he in turn handed it to the woman that sat to his left.
The boon was for a few minutes, but you spoke for many hours.
I was negotiating the surrender of her army.
Kyair smiled slightly. Every word you utter is ridiculous, the woman said.
Only because you think I am a pretender.
The woman looked as if she was about to spit back a retort, but Kenneth slapped his leg, creating a sound like a thunderclap, and interrupted her.
If you are Kyair, how is it that you are still alive?
Kenneth asked.
Malak put me in the Radical. Nayar and Jesme, her bodyguard Graykin, a boy named Pog, and the Duke's daughter woke me.
The handsome man nodded to each of us. Our eyes briefly met, and I felt warmth spread through my body.
The story of the betrayer is many thousands of years old. He was jealous of Malak and Shlara's love, and it corrupted his heart. After the Elvens were defeated, he lashed out at them, and a new war started. Eventually, he was killed by the combined might of his generals.
Kenneth's warriors nodded while he spoke, except for Aharon.
Perspective and time change stories.
Kyair opened his mouth to say more, but instead he sighed and looked into the fire.
Obviously, your leaders know I am still alive,
he finally said.
Obviously. Why else would there be such motivation to find someone with the same name? Why else call them a pretender and capture them? One or all of your clan leaders know that I wasn't killed and might return.
I could see Kenneth turn the words in his head with a frown. I didn't understand entirely what Kyair spoke of, but it made sense that if these clan leaders knew he would eventually wake one day, they would need to find a way to capture him.
Other pretenders have been found and brought before them,
Kenneth said. His face still looked like he was puzzling through what my lover had told him.
Have you ever seen them? No. This was before I was born.
Kenneth nodded.
Were any of you alive when the last pretender was captured?
Kyair asked the gathered warriors. Each shook their head.
But your clan receives a reward for bringing me back alive.
Kyair looked at Kenneth.
Yes. That is large enough for you to leave your budding clan and travel to this world to capture me.
Kenneth shifted in his seat and nodded. Jason passed the jug of wine to me, but I didn't drink from it. Instead, I hefted it with both hands and handed it to Kair. He took it from me, and I relished the feeling of our fingers briefly touching. I quickly remembered where my focus should be and looked back at Kenneth. The large man had the usual frown on his face and stared into the fire. Kair tilted the jug and took three large gulps of the liquid. Each sound of him swallowing cut through the empty air and made me wish I had partaken of the wine. He shook the jug after he finished, and the clay rang empty.
"I think I would have liked you, Kenneth," Kair said.
The big man snorted and gave a slightly amused expression.
"You need better mentorship and training, but would have done well in my army. Probably not a general, of course, but you could have been one of Thayer's commanders if he had spent some time on you."
Kair's voice had a strange echo to it, like he was talking through his mouth and nose at the same time.
"More words that mean nothing to me," Kenneth said.
"I have an eye for talent, but I am not as gifted as my mentor was. His name was Entus.
Do the stories of me mention him?"
"I am not familiar with the name."
The rest of his warriors shook their heads, except for Iaren.
"That is unfortunate. He was really the soul of my army. Taught me everything I know. I always believed him to be slightly insane, but the more I remember about my past, the more I begin to realize that I wasn't paying enough attention to the meaning behind his words."
"You are insane," the woman said.
"Maybe."
He laughed and leaned back on the log.
"I am actually considering letting you take me to your clan leaders. I think the conversation would be interesting. But I still have a few thousand elvens to worry about here."
He turned to me and smiled.
"So I'll have to take care of that first. You do not have a choice in the matter of pretender."
Kenneth sighed, and I could see the woman who had thrown the jug at Kair's head roll her eyes back.
"There are always choices, if you look hard enough."
Kair smiled, but it was all teeth.
"Iaren, are you feeling all right?"
"Sure."
The woodsman gasped from his side of the fire and cooking pot. It seemed obvious to me that Iaren was not okay. His hands shook and beads of sweat dripped down his forehead.
"I wasn't surprised to find out you were one of my people."
"Why weren't you surprised?"
Anax's gravelly voice asked.
"They were all afraid of me when I awoke, but Iaren was terrified."
"That doesn't mean anything. He's skittish and practically useless in combat."
Jason spat out. Iaren caught his breath and his brows knitted in anger.
"You know I am Kair."
He ignored Jason's words and stared across the fire at the thin woodsman.
"Yes,"
the woodsman said after a brief pause. "So if Iaren says it, then it must be true. Oh, great betrayer." Gaiska made a bow from her sitting position. "We both fear and revere you. Tell us how to serve." Kair smiled at their laughter, and I wondered how he could stay so calm when the situation felt so hopeless.
"Fear is a good motivator."
"It is hard to be afraid of someone chained up as you are while surrounded by our kind. Plus, we have your friends as leverage." The woman sneered.
"I guess that explains why you didn't set a sentry."
Kair shook his head, and his smile changed into a look of pity.
"It would have been one of the first lessons taught you in my army. We were always afraid of the elvens destroying us. Leave Iaren alive, but kill the others."
I found myself on the ground behind the log on which we had been sitting. There was a gust of wind and the sound of quick-moving bees above us. I yelped in surprise and grabbed onto Kair's hand on my chest. Where did the manacles go? I looked over to him, but he was already getting up off the dirt. I saw the shape of my uncle's face, but could not see his expression since the log blocked the light from the fire. Then I was lifted to my feet and standing face to face with my lover.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. His back was to the fire, his face in shadow, save his green eyes. "Yes, I think." He smiled at me and then helped Beltor stand. "What did you speak to my sister about?" The voice spoke from behind, and I was so surprised I jumped around with my heart in my throat. Behind me stood dozens of dark, garbed figures with short black bows in their hands. The one in the front of the group removed her cowl to reveal a ghostly white face and snow-colored hair. An elfin. Her eyes shone black and orange in the firelight.
It was our own business. One of your soldiers has bad aim, though.
Fair pointed back at the fire, and I turned to follow his finger. They were all dead, punctured by dozens of black shafted arrows like a macabre pincushion. I felt my head go light and nausea fill my stomach. Less than a few seconds ago, these had been living, breathing, talking people. They were intimidating, but had not done me any wrong.
Your sister and I needed Ayeran alive to show us where the radical they came through is located,
Kaer said. There was a single arrow in the woodsman's forehead, and the fire reflected off his dead eyes as they stared into the night sky. She will forgive me. What did you speak to her about? The white-haired elven asked again.
Looks like she is keeping secrets from you. Ask her when we return.
Kaer walked over to Ayeran and crouched down next to him. I am asking you now. Her voice rose slightly in anger, and I felt my uncle pull me a bit away from the woman so I wasn't standing between her and Kaer.
I'm sorry, my friend.
Kaer's hand brushed over Ayeran's face, closing his eyes.
I understood what you had to do. I hope you can understand what I had to do.
I am sick of your presence, Pretender. You make a mockery of our customs and achievements.
Well, that's fine. You already know what I think of you. Now that the Princess and Duke of Naya are safe, we should return to the Empress. We have to continue our negotiations for your surrender.
Our surrender? The woman's eyes narrowed, and a few of the black-clothed archers behind her shifted their feet.
Take it up with her.
Kaer started looking through the various packs on the ground. The third one he looked into had been at Kenneth's feet. It was larger than the rest and seemed well padded. Kaer smiled for a brief second and then wrapped both of the straps over his shoulder.
Have some of your warriors bury them. We'll take the horses and head back to Naya.
Kaer walked toward the white woman, but she drew her sword slowly. As if it was a conductor's command, the rest of the archers pulled on their arrows and leveled them at the thin, handsome man.
That is a bad idea.
Kaer said. He crossed his arms and took a small step away from her. Your kind is quite foolish. You believe you are so powerful with your mastery of the elements. You ignore the dead gods that created us. You believe that these worlds are yours to defile however you see fit. Our people struggled for so many years and have finally escaped your control. Then you show up and attempt to yoke us again.
From my memories, it was the other way around.
Kaer seethed. That past is useless. The present is the only time that matters, Pretender. She took a step closer to him, and Kaer uncrossed his arms. I felt Beltor's arm tighten around me, and he pulled me back a step. Do you know that there is other magic besides the elements? The woman smiled, and her teeth were actually whiter than her skin.
I wouldn't be surprised.
The point of her sword was a few inches from Kaer's thin chest now. Our people were given them by our gods to help us survive. You know my sisters already. Would you like me to tell you what mine is? Her sword tip touched Kaer's chest. Their eyes were locked, but my lover didn't seem nervous.
Lack of foresight?
Kaer grinned. No. If someone makes eye contact with me, I can prevent them from moving for a few seconds. It is why I have never been defeated in combat. The woman smiled while she slowly pulled back her sword arm and then lashed out with it. I screamed. Beltor pulled me away. Her sword continued its arc through the air. Kaer's body fell, and his head rolled to our feet. His jaw was still clenched in anger. I screamed. The darkness was too much. It
The horrible woman was yelling something at us, but I couldn't hear her. There was blood coming out of her nose. She took a step toward us, and the world grew darker. Then darker. Kair was dead.
Chapter 19. The Obarni. Sometimes a sleep is so deep that the dreams are only of darkness. Time doesn't pass, and when it is interrupted, the shock can be as stressful as actually being killed. Or so I guessed. After we were changed into Obarni, our senses became so powerful, so precise, and so encompassing. It drove many of the first humans experimented on to insanity. It didn't help that the elvens kept us in tight cages, hunched over like animals, until they decided that we had either survived the change with our sanity intact and were ready for training, or had become monsters. I sat up in the bed and stifled a gasp. I thought the scream came from my memory, but it had originated outside of the window. Laughter followed it quickly, and the sound of a group of drunken voices escalated into tones of mockery. I crept silently to the glass and peered at the cobblestone street 40 feet below my window. Half a dozen men and women walked through the streets. It was hard for people infused with magic to get drunk. Our bodies healed from most poisons too quickly, so I assumed the revelers were human and on their way home from a late night of tavern escapades. I sighed and crept back to the bed. On the nightstand sat a small oil lamp and a large wooden bowl of water. I splashed some of the water on my face and got dressed. There was no sense in returning to sleep now that the night had awoken me. My clothes were newly purchased, and they scratched uncomfortably against my skin when I moved across the wood floor to the door of my room. With a turn of the key and a silent descent down 3 flights of stairs, I made my way out of the inn and into the streets of the dark city. This was the second inn I had patronized in the last month. The third identity I had taken, and the fourth time I had made a small step toward freeing Iola Rothi from the bowels of the prison built to hold elven captives. The preparations were almost in place, and if I could execute them perfectly, she would be free in 2 nights. Then we would be together. Shlara's Rest was the largest city within 1,000 miles. From the stories told to me by the locals, Malak, along with Shlara's commanders, had carried her burnt body here after I killed her. They had laid her into the ground on a site overlooking the nearby river. Ironically, the spot where her bronze and stone memorial stood was almost exactly the same place where we had once sat together, discussing our future before sparring with each other. That had been 14 years ago. I had almost killed her then. Even though my army had been victorious in eliminating the elven threat, there was still work to be done. There were elven settlements throughout the world that must be sought and eliminated. It would take an organized effort to comb the continent and eradicate the remainder of them. There was also the issue of leadership. The Obarni's leader had deserted them and killed one of his generals. The people in the army were promised freedom from the oppressors, and that had now come true. What came next? Who would lead them in this new life of freedom? From what I had gleaned from listening to the locals in the taverns, a small group comprised of my generals and their commanders had gone to the river to wash after Shlara was laid to rest. They planned their next steps and tried to come to terms with the loss. While they sat on the banks of the river, one of them noticed gold flakes amongst the silt. Gold had never been valuable to us during the war, but the elvens used it for currency. The idea of mining the metal sprang into their minds, and a center of trade and industry sprung up around the new mine. Thus, the city of Shlara's Rest was born. I guessed that my lover was searching for an ovule. It was a round globe, about the size of a skull, and filled with a soft yellow light that matched the spiderweb-like lines of the inside of a radicle. The elven elder had told me that Iola Rothi traveled with a girl to his radicle, and that the girl had used the last of the ovule's power and somehow left this world. The ancient elven had not been able to tell me much more. He called the world by a number, said Iola Rothi was looking for another ovule, and told me that the girl was my daughter. I guessed he was lying. But I couldn't beat the truth out of him. A trio of Alexia's hunters, led by one of my former bodyguards, Lamarty, had been chasing me for years, and finally caught up to me in the radical. Lamarty possessed martial skill beyond even my best soldiers, and I had been lucky to defeat them. Unfortunately, the old elven died before giving me the information that I needed about Iola Rothi, the child he said looked like me, and how the radical worked. Iola Rothi's trail had been surprisingly easy to follow after I almost found her at the strange shrine. There were four large human settlements between the radical and Shlara's Rest. The elven woman had visited each one, skirted the edges of the towns for a few days, and then moved on to the next. I didn't understand how she planned on even finding an ovule, let alone getting inside one of the cities to steal one of the globes. Maybe she had gotten desperate and decided to risk capture. Whatever her reasoning was, Iola Rothi's luck had run out in the city appropriately named after the woman who almost killed her. I stopped at an intersection a mile from the inn. The street was paved in river rocks and clay, pounded flat by a decade of horses, wagon wheels, and footsteps. In this poorer part of the city, the roofs were crafted of steep, graying thatch that would burn easily. I expanded my hearing to take in the sounds of hundreds of sleeping people resting comfortably in their homes. I heard a soft footstep a few streets over, but it was moving away. Once I was satisfied that no one was following me, I turned toward the largest structure in the city, the barracks. When I first came to Shlara's Rest, I dyed my hair gray with limestone mineral extracts I had gathered a few thousand miles away. It was scentless and made me look older, even if my face was still frozen in youth. To further accentuate the disguise, I walked the last stretch of my journey to the town with a sharpened rock in my boot to get myself used to treading off camber on one leg, and then carried the hobble with me. Once in the city, I found the local tavern the wardens visited when they were not patrolling. Some of the faces I recognized, but none of the warriors who lived in Shlara's Rest suspected that the gray-haired man limping from table to table to collect their soiled tableware was Kyair. The wardens talked, and I could listen to the entire room with my heightened sense, even while in the back washing the dishes. Within a few days, I knew that they had captured Iola Rothi, but they had not guessed her identity. I also got a rough idea of their shifts and patrol routes. I continued my work at the tavern until one of the soldiers mentioned that the stables in the city's barracks needed another worker. Within an hour, the gray was washed out of my hair, the limp was gone, and I was mucking out the massive 40-horse stable in the same barracks that held Iola Rothi's prison. The two other stable boys were thankful for the help. They didn't ask more than the usual questions about where I was born, what my parents did, what role they played in the war, and if I knew any girls that they could fuck. The horsemaster of the barracks had been one of Gorbani's lower lieutenants, and didn't recognize me nor question my sudden appearance. Now I had a more detailed view of the workings in the barracks. I could see exactly when everyone was coming and going and what their duties were. While I didn't have access to the underground dungeon where they kept Iola Rothi, I knew where it was and could observe the shift changes of the guards. I began to piece together a plan for freeing her, but there were still too many variables I had not mastered. Once I had memorized the pattern of the stable work and the barrack traffic, I decided to make my move. Between lunch and supper, the support staff busied themselves with cleaning, and the trained soldiers left the barracks to go on patrol. The stable boys normally napped, as the addition of my hands had considerably lightened their workload. This gave me the perfect window. I made a habit of taking some dessert and wine from the kitchen, walking to the dungeon, and delivering the offering to whichever guard was working that day. The sentries were O'Barney, but I made sure they saw me as nothing but an over-eager stable boy looking for a promotion. After a week of hobnobbing with the guards, I managed to get a tour of the dungeon. It was specifically built to hold elven prisoners or O'Barney who had violated the non-violence laws in Shlara's Rest. The bars of each cell were made of 3-inch-thick solid steel, driven 5 feet into the floor and ceiling. There were 20 elvens in the cells and 4 O'Barney. I didn't see Iola Rothi, but at the end of the tour, the proud guardsmen showed me their solitary confinement cell. It was set down 2 levels of stairs at the end of a long hallway. The door was crafted of the gray metal we used to forge our armor and weapons. I asked the sentry who was inside, and he confirmed that it was an elven woman with hair the color of blood. I could have killed the guard there, taken his keys, and released Iola Rothi then, but I hadn't finished planning our escape from the city. A creaking sound from a nearby roof tore me from my recollection of the plan. I stopped my walk and focused my attention on the origin of the noise a few dozen yards away. A tabby cat hung from the gutter of a bakery and eyed me suspiciously. I took a slow breath to steady my nerves and continued my stroll down the road toward the barracks. It was a large, 3-tower structure, wrapped with a jigsaw wall of timber and massive stone blocks that seemed to push against the nearby houses like an angry child. The fortress was capable of housing a few hundred soldiers, training them within the inner courtyard and defending against attacks. It was much larger than anything I had ever seen an elven tribe build, but they often trained their warriors in the open fields surrounding their estates, and the warriors dwelled with their own small families. Elvens had little use for jails. If someone was discovered violating their laws, they dealt swift justice with an axe blade. After a few more minutes of walking the empty streets, I came within 100 yards of the plaid walls. It was the middle of fall, but Shlara's Rest sat close enough to the river and ocean to make the temperatures mild. Still, some of the wardens that stood watch on the 80-foot-high walls were not O'Barney, and they needed braziers of fire to keep warm. I was thankful for their light, because it revealed spots in the defense where I might sneak in and out should my plan not work as expected. I continued meandering around the perimeter of the wall, going slower than was natural to remain inconspicuous. Most of the homes and stores butted up within touching distance of the barrier, but I still took my time to walk slow and silent, listening to the sounds of the sleeping inhabitants, the wind, and the idle chatter of the watchmen on the walls. I had always been cautious in my battle plans, and now, with so much at stake, was no time to be careless and lax in my preparation. This had to work. In 2 nights, the small sailing vessel, Sea Dog, would leave the harbor heading downriver 3 miles, and then into the deep sea to begin a month-long voyage to the Juniper Isles. It was the fastest ship I knew of, and the captain had already accepted my payment. The small crew didn't ask any questions. If they did, the tiny, sleek ship could be managed by two people. I had been thinking of a way for Io Lorothi and me to escape quickly, with little trace, in a way that would be hard for my expertly trained soldiers to track. I knew a little about sailing, but nearly all of my life had been spent on land or horseback. As was true of most of my soldiers, the sea was intimidating, chaotic and unpredictable, and easily able to foil the magic that kept us immortal. We could hold our breath for much longer than a normal human, but if the ship sunk into deep waters, our magic could not save us from death. It was the third job I had taken after my stint as a stable boy. To find a suitable escape vessel, I'd wandered the harbor and helped the half-dozen ships unload their cargo. I chatted with their crews and made friends with their captains. As fate would have it, Sea Dog was one of the first boats I approached, and the first mate asked if I would be available to crew when they left port. After a discussion over a bitter ale, I'd worked out the terms of my brief employment, and both the captain and first mate agreed to take my wife as a passenger. "Fuck, it's cold," a voice said from the wall above me on the south side of the barracks. "Eh, but at least you're off at dawn," another voice whispered. "I might stick around and watch them chop that elven bitch into pieces," the first voice said. I stopped. "Huh? The one they had in that special cell. They are executing her at dawn." I recognized the voice of Tillian, one of the more experienced wall sentries. "You don't say. I thought they were going to keep her in there forever. Was it true that she killed three of our wardens when they caught her?" the second voice asked. I didn't recognize his voice, but I hadn't been able to speak with all of the guards that worked in the barracks. "I wasn't there. Heard that she broke into Malik's estate and attacked his students." I moved closer to the wall and assessed the surface for climbing. I had heard a few rumors of her capture, but this sounded closest to the truth. She must have thought that the ovule was being kept in Malik's home, and she was probably correct. Malik had come to collect several trophies and interesting artwork from the elvens. "I know that she bit Commander Grilp's nose off yesterday when he questioned her. From my memory, Grilp was one of Malik's captains. I recalled Malik giving him logistic detail instead of active combat duty. I was just thankful that someone from Shlara or Alexia's army had not been assigned to interrogate Io Lorothi. Their methods were effectively brutal on our enemy. It couldn't have happened to a bigger asshole." They both chuckled. "He ordered it. Might even wield the axe. Do you think any of the generals will be there?" "Nah, they don't give a fuck about the elvens anymore. If Malik was in the city, he might show up, but he's been gone for the last year," Tillian said. "Too bad. I've never seen one. I saw Thayer a few years ago. He was as scary as they say he is. Looked like the kind of man that eats raw iron for breakfast." Their conversation devolved into a debate about which general would win in a battle, but my mind had already flown into action. I knew they had been questioning Io Lorothi, but no one seemed to think of her as more than a particularly aggressive prisoner of war. It was also possible that this was a trap, but I couldn't imagine a low-ranked guard being privy to such a ruse. And it was true that none of the generals were supposed to be in the city at the moment. My old friends were not involved in her capture or sentence of execution. I was just being paranoid. But paranoia had kept me from being captured by countless Obarni hunters for the last 12 years. The ship would leave in 2 days, but I had to move now. Io Lorothi would be dead in the morning, and I needed to take the risk. Fortunately, I had anticipated the possibility that I would have to free her before the Sea Dog left, and had scouted out a few spots where we could wait. one of which was the inn where I currently stayed. It wasn't the safest strategy, but we would have to make it work. If not for the loud drunkards outside my room, I would have still been asleep and missed this conversation, and my love would have been executed. I walked around the walls of the barracks and toward the front gate of the complex. My heart beat faster than normal, so I forced it to calm. There was a mixture of O'Barney and normal humans here. If an O'Barney thought I looked suspicious, I didn't want to give them an additional reason to question me. As expected, there were two guards at the gate, bunched together over a small fire pit. "Good evening, Decker." I didn't know the other guard, but Decker gave me a friendly smile. I walked past the two of them and into the courtyard. They didn't bother to stop me and probably thought I was running a stable boy errand or out chasing girls. The courtyard was empty, and I met no opposition on my short walk to the stables. Once inside, I crept silently past the sleeping horses and up to the hayloft where the stable boys slept. The loft was big enough for each of the young men to get a good-sized corner to himself, and the night concealed my movements. I climbed to the top rafter above my corner and ran my hands through the darkness. My fingers brushed the strap of my leather pack, and I carefully pulled the bag from its hiding place. Inside was a weapon belt that sheathed a short sword and dagger, two hooded cloaks, a large jug of very spiced wine, lock-picking tools, and a dozen throwing darts loaded in a leather satchel that firmly attached to my belt. Once armed, I crept out of the stables and sneaked toward the dungeon entrance. I heard the various guards conversing on the walls in their usual manner. In fact, the environment matched every night I had observed during my stint as a stable worker, so my hopes raised that this part of my plan might be completed without complication. It was a few hundred yards to the prison, but I had become well-versed in the arts of stealth by now. Shadows made more noise than I did, and were probably more visible in the night than my sneaking form. The outside door to the jail was thick wood, with stout iron rails that wrapped around it like a cross. The hinges once screeched when moved, but I had applied a liberal coat of grease to them late one night, and the door swung with little more than a whisper. Of course, that only helped if anyone were to be listening outside of the dungeon. The guard inside would sense the change in air pressure and wonder who approached. If he was paying attention. "Who goes there?" A call rang from deep within the torchlit tunnel. The voice was Fenzen, one of the dungeon guards with whom I had the best relationship. He had first given me a tour of the cells and would be the happiest to see me. My luck was indeed good tonight. "And set, sir. I can't sleep and thought you might want to play a game of dice. Does a bear shit in the woods? I'm fucking bored as hell down here." I walked the stone tunnel and then down the short flight of steps to the guard table. When I first introduced myself to Fenzen, I had remarked at how odd it was that there was just one guard down here. He agreed that it was boring, but apparently the watch commander had found the two previous guards drunk and asleep one night. He then decided that the shift only needed one sentry moving forward, one that was an O'Barney. It worked out well for Fenzen, since he took the position and both salaries. The promotion would not end well for him tonight. I had thought of a dozen different ways to get past the guard without murder. I could have used poison, some sort of distraction, maybe talked my way through. I even thought about sneaking by, but the stone corridor was too narrow, well lit, and the only guards stationed here were unlikely to be asleep. Even if one of the less violent methods worked, they would know my face, the fake name I used, and once my generals put the pieces together, they would increase the resources hunting for me. "Couldn't sleep, huh?" he asked when I stepped toward him. He sat on one of the stout oak chairs, with his booted feet upon the table. "Nah, too cold, and those assholes snore." I reached my right hand out to pass him the dice, and then grabbed his wrist. I stepped to the side of the table, to his left, and yanked his arm while I drew my dagger. Even for an O'Barney, I was fast and strong. Fenzen thought I was only a human, and his face didn't have a chance to register surprise before my blade sunk into his temple and ended his life. I let out a long breath and cradled his body before it hit the stone floor. He wasn't the first of my kin I had been forced to kill, but the others had been in self-defense, or at least I justified my actions because my capture meant death. But this was murder, and I could not fool myself into thinking otherwise. Regret filled my heart like a sick tidal wave. I had agonized over this decision for many days, but I knew this outcome was still wrong. Unfortunately, I didn't have the imagination to think of a better way to free her. Was Iolorothi's life worth more than one of my people? I had already proven to myself that it was, since Shlara was dead. I cradled Fenzen's limp body in my right arm and grabbed the set of keys with my left. A few paces behind the table was another wood door that led to the cells. I found the key quickly and opened the door. The hinges on this one creaked, but I had expected as much. The dungeon had a simple layout, 3 floors of about 100 yards on each level. At the end of each hallway, a set of stairs led down to the next floor. Only a quarter of the torches lit the walls. Fenzen explained to me that the prisoners were given food and water in the morning. If this was true, I had about 5 hours before anyone would notice something was amiss. I passed a few cells housing sleeping prisoners. Even carrying the weight of Fenzen's body, I moved silently and had no fear of waking them. My cloak covered my face, so if one of the captives saw me, they would not be able to make out my features. The stench of shit, piss, vomit, and death filled my nose as I dug deeper into the dungeon. The bottom floor held their elven prisoners, who were given little attention and often left to starve as a punishment. There were about 10 of them, locked in cramped cells. The first time I had been down here, I acted like I expected a young stable boy to behave, forcing myself to gasp and gag. The smell was horrible, but I had experienced much worse after a battle. I lay Fenzen's corpse at the end of the hallway and began trying the assortment of keys on the massive steel door of Iolorothi's cell. The third key I tried worked, and the gray steel door moved open with a gentle push. The torches on the wall behind me did little to illuminate the inside of the cell, but my eyes could see in almost complete darkness. Crouched in the corner opposite the door was a figure clothed in a dirty sheet with one arm shackled to the wall. "Do not speak." I pulled on her shoulder to turn her toward me. Her face was covered with dirt and mud, but her eyes shone with animal intensity. Her unchained arm lashed out at my face, but I grabbed it with my other hand. The blow should have been strong enough to knock me over, but her strength was little more than that of a normal human. "Look at me. Look at me. Look at me," I said, until her eyes seemed to register my face. She stopped struggling and gasped. Her silver eyes grew in size, and her mouth opened in complete shock. "Do not speak," I whispered again, and she nodded. Then I moved to her shackle and tried the keys. There were 20 on the ring, but none of them worked. I guessed that would be the case, so I pulled out my lockpicks, inserted the tension tool, and scraped the curved pick across the teeth of the lock. My advanced sense made the task easy, since I could feel and hear the pin's tiny movements. In half a minute, the lock was defeated, and I had released the shackle on Iolorothi's wrist. I should have picked the lock to start. I helped her stand, and her hand ran over my shoulder, finally squeezing along my bicep. The contact was electrifying, and I resisted the urge to take her in my arms and kiss her. I needed to stay focused on the next few parts of my mission, or all could be lost. As soon as we exited her cell, I picked up Fenzen's body and moved it into her place, even clasping his dead wrist into the shackle. Then I locked the door behind us and led her across the dungeon floor and up the flights of stairs. I hung up the key ring by the table and pulled out the extra cloak and the jug of spiced wine from my pack. I gave Iola Rothy the cloak, and she donned it carefully. Then I uncorked the strong-smelling wine and poured it over the small bloodstain on the stone tiles, over the chair, and over the table. I left the bottle tipped over on the table, dripping slightly onto the stone. If my luck continued to hold, the guard relieving Fenzen in the morning would think that he got drunk and abandoned his shift. Iola Rothy inhaled deeply once we stepped outside of the dungeon. I pointed toward the back wall, away from the front gate, and she followed me in that direction. To reach the top of the wall, the wardens climbed straight stairs that attached to the stone barrier on the right, but were open to the courtyard on the left. The stairway we took was the least exposed, but we could still be seen from two of the wardens' posts, should they choose to look into the courtyard. The steps led right up to another station, and I heard guards chatting at the top about a dice game. I motioned for Iola Rothy to stay at the foot of the stairs, and I pulled out two darts from the pouch attached to my belt. The tips were doused with a strong, paralyzing poison that would knock out any human quickly. I had another half dozen with a different type of drug for O'Barney, but a human exposed to the toxin would die in a few seconds. So she sits back in her chair, all coy-like, fluttering her eyelashes at me, one of the guards said from above me. Then what? Another voice asked. I took a swig of drink and then rolled. And? Snake eyes, he shouted. His voice echoed across the courtyard, and I pulled myself down the stairs to avoid anyone looking in this direction. My heart jumped in my chest, and I forced myself to calm. The night was dark, and the fires on top of the wall did not bring enough light to reveal my presence on the shadowed stairs, even for an O'Barney. No shit. Did she let you fuck her? That was the deal, wasn't it? I bent her right over the dice table. Damn. Lucky roll. I used loaded dice. Wasn't that much luck involved. The two men howled, and I moved up the steps a bit, glancing across the courtyard to the other posts on the wall that could see me. The other guards were not looking, so I crept up the stairs and peered over the edge of the stone rail. My two targets warmed their hands around the fire and faced out toward the city with their backs to me. If I was alone, I could have sprung over the wall and disappeared over the other ledge with no sound or detectable movement. I imagined Iola Rothy would have been able to do the same if she was fit, but I didn't want to risk such a maneuver with her now. She had leaned on me during most of our walk up the dungeon stairs, and if she were seen, the entire force of the city would be looking for us. I tossed the darts out with one practiced throw. Both of them sunk into the target's butt cheeks, and the humans slumped to the floor almost instantly. I didn't actually think that the poison would work so quickly, and I realized that I may have put too much of the liquid on the tips of the darts. I moved to their bodies, yanked out the darts, and then leaned them up against one of the stone blocks on the barricade so that they sat out of view. Then I looked down the stairs and motioned for Iola Rothy. She crept up on all fours, stopping 15 feet from the top, and then jumped up the remainder of the length of the vertical wall so she remained out of the light of the fire. I moved over to meet her and motioned for her to wait a few seconds. After they passed, and I hadn't heard a guard raise an alarm, I started to believe that we would actually escape. It was an 80-foot drop to the street below. It was a fall I could make with no damage, but I doubted an elven could, especially one who had been weakened by malnutrition and whatever other horrors she had endured in the dungeons. I gestured for Iola Rothy to wrap her arms around my shoulders, and she did without question. Then my hands searched for the first holds on the edge of the wall before I lowered us down the edge quietly. I listened again once we reached the bottom. Still no call of alert from the walls, so we walked through the city's streets toward the inn. We walked slowly, like normal people would stroll through the street on